This was the four animals, right? You guys remember that? Right, so, quick, fast, and easy. Daniel has this vision, and in this vision he sees a lion with eagle's wings, right? And this is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the new Babylonian Empire, right? And the wings get ripped off, and talks about, you know, that's the equivalent of Nebuchadnezzar getting strict power when he was taken out of his mind for a little bit. The bear was raised up on his side, had three ribs in its mouth. You guys remember what the bear symbolized?
Persia.
What's that?
Persia.
Yeah, the Medo-Persian Empire. That's exactly right. It was up on its side because Persia takes over from an allied empire. It was too late to clean the Persian Empire. And the three ribs were Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. Those are the three main conquests of the Medo-Persian Empire. So Daniel saw that before it ever came to pass, that they even existed. Then he also saw a leopard with four bird wings, right? And then this is a representative of who? Very fast, very ferocious warrior.
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great, exactly right. Alexander the Great was the first that we have in history. He was the first military commander that used what the Nazis in World War II later used called Blitzkrieg, where they move in with just lightning speed and wipe out the defenses and overwhelm the enemy forces before anybody knows what's going on. He created that conquest. And his massive empire was split into four parts following his death in 323 BC. Then the last thing that Daniel saw, this is back in Daniel chapter 7, was number four, was the terrifying and dreadful beast. It was unlike any other beast, right? And we looked at Revelation 13 to kind of get an idea of what it might look like. He described it as exceedingly strong, teeth of iron, claws of bronze, right? It broke everything that it came in contact with. He ripped it and broke it to pieces, stomped on it, destroyed it. Make sense? And we talked about what that equated to in history. What did we come up with? The Roman Empire, right? So this terrifying, dreadful beast is symbolized the Roman Empire. Now, how do we know that? Well, a few different things. It had 10 horns, right? That's a biblical number that's referencing completeness. But there was also the 10 horns and the 10 toes from Daniel chapter 2 that represented the Roman Empire, the fourth empire to come, right? Made up of clay and iron. Now, we looked at this too. What did the Roman Empire give us that no other empire in the history of the world gave us? Right? Rome was based on the Greek Empire, right? And what form of government did they bring into existence that had not been in existence before at any scale?
Democracy.
Yeah, they brought in a representative government, Senate. Right? Now, that was all Daniel 7. So we look at that and we see what Daniel identified. Now we get to Daniel 8. And he has another vision, right? Now I'm going to walk you through a little bit of a timeline here because now we're getting into what's called prophecy, right? So these things that happened in Daniel's previous vision, they've come to pass. The Roman Empire has come. It's fallen. But now we're going to look at stuff that in his visions, much of which has come to pass and some that has not. Does that make sense? Right? So before I do that, I'm going to... Actually, I will walk you through the timeline first up to a point, and then we're going to watch a quick video. All right, so check this out. In 606 BC, right, a major event takes place. Babylon is the rising force in the region, and they finally take over the critically important, strategically important city of Jerusalem, right? Now, in the Middle East, when they would build cities, they build them with two main things in mind, three if they could. One, water source, okay? You had to have water if you're going to survive, period. So they would generally build cities next to rivers, right, or near water sources, okay? Two, they would want high ground, right? Can anybody tell me why?
To be able to defend better.
Yeah, has anybody ever played King of the Hill? It's always easier to defend from the top of the hill than it is to get the guy off, right? It's easier to defend when it's on high ground. And the third thing that they would want is access to some type of a trade network, all right? Like road network, some way that they could move goods back and forth for flourishing of the city through production means and economic means. Jerusalem sat with all three of those. High ground, it had access to water, right, that was drilled, right, or dug out, not drilled, but dug through the tunnels, rock tunnels, to get access to underground water supplies that no enemy could poison or access, okay? That's huge. And then it also had access to a road network, as well as, various road networks for trade. Now, 606, Jerusalem's captured by Nebuchadnezzar, right? Head of the Babylonians. 605 is when Daniel is taken as a young man, probably about 12 years old, right? He's taken to Babylon. In 602, that's when Nebuchadnezzar has that vision of the statue, right? Golden head at the top represents Babylon. You remember that statue vision that he had? Or the dream he had greatly troubled him, right? And then he asks all his wise men. He's like, hey, you guys need to figure this out for me? And none of them can, right? So he's going to kill them all until Daniel's like, well, let me go ask my God. And he does. And of course, our God, being the God he is, gives him the interpretation. So he goes and he tells Nebuchadnezzar both his dream and the interpretation of the dream. That elevates Daniel to a key position in the government. That's Daniel chapter 2. Now, here we are. He's doing his job from 602 to 589, okay? That's 13 years. So how old is Daniel, do you think? Just about. What's 15 plus 13?
28.
Yeah, he's about 28 years old. Pretty good age, right? When he's about 28 years old, that's when Babylon destroys Jerusalem, okay? So they took it. They captured the city. They're still having trouble with rebellion such that they just waxed Jerusalem. So from 589 to 586, Jerusalem is destroyed in a siege. They rebel and they're destroyed. That's covered in 2 Kings chapter 25. In 563 BC, that's when we see Nebuchadnezzar lose his sanity, right? So now Daniel is in to middle age, right? Daniel 4 covers that. In 553, that's when King Belshazzar takes over Babylon. Okay, so we've got 47 years plus, we'll just say 12, right? Well, 605, 7. 47 plus 7. It's about 54 years old. Now, King Belshazzar takes over, and that's when Daniel has the four beasts dream that we just went over. And he keeps it secret, right? Anybody tell me why Daniel didn't go and tell the king when he has that vision, King Belshazzar? Was he a good guy or a bad guy? Yeah, absolutely. He's the guy with the handwriting on the wall that was waxed, okay? Mm-hmm. God took him out through the means of the Medo-Persian Empire. So we got the handwriting on the wall in 539 BC, okay, in the fall of Babylon. About 537, that's incorrect, I apologize. It should be 7. About 537 is when we see the lion's den. 538, 537, right around there. Okay, we're not quite sure. That's when Daniel gets tossed under the bus and he spends the night in Lion Kingdom, right? That's under King who? Yeah, that's right. That's under King Darius. Yeah, exactly, because the Medes have already taken over, right? And now, that's covered by Daniel chapter 6. Then we get to 536. Daniel 12 identifies Daniel dies in about 536 BC, right? Now notice, in 538 BC, that's when King Cyrus, right here, right? He took over for Darius. That's when King Cyrus releases the Jews from their captivity. Okay? Now that's awesome because when they go back, that's covered in Ezra 1. When they go back, Ezra chapter 6 identifies in 515 BC the building of the foundation of the temple and the altar and the sacrifices that come back before God. Now that's important because how many years were they supposed to be in captivity? Starts with 7, ends with 0. 70, exactly right. Yeah, it was prophesied by Isaiah that they were going to be in captivity for 70 years. Okay? And if you do the math, from when Jerusalem is destroyed in 606 to 538, okay, how many years? Take a guess. Sorry, 536. 515 when the temple's completed. 515 to 606. Yeah, it comes out to about 70 years. Depending on how you count the months, right? But it's 70-year time. I know the numbers are like 71, but that's because we're going from mid-year to mid-year. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's 70 years, and they complete it, right? God fulfills his prophecy. That's a big deal. Now, that brings us up to this point with the death of Daniel, okay? But now we got this questionable vision that he had, right? So before Daniel dies, obviously, he has this vision of a ram, a goat, and another beast, okay, that we later identify as the Antichrist. I'm going to play this video for you. Let me know if you guys need me to turn up the volume.
I
saw myself in the citadel of Sup.
Oh, I forgot to tell you. This is a reading right out of Daniel, chapter 8. So if you got your Bibles handy and you want to read along in the NIV version, you're more than welcome. But this is, to break this out, Daniel chapter 8, the first half is his vision. The second half is the interpretation of the prophecy given to him by the angel Gabriel. Okay? This goes back and forth between the two. That's why I like the video. All right, here it goes.
I saw myself in the citadel of Susa, in the province of Elam, beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns, standing beside the canal. And the horns were long, but one of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. The two-horned ram represents the kings of Media, Persia. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The shaggy goat is the king of Yavan. And
Yavan is the Hebrew word for Greece.
The large horn between its eyes is the first king. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small, but grew up in power, to the south and to the east, and toward the beautiful land, Israel. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent the four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down. A fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, will rise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy those who are mighty, the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. He will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. And yet, he will be utterly destroyed, and not by human hands.
All right.
Wait, that means unicorns are biblical.
Unicorns are biblical. Yeah, if you want to look in the Hebrew word, though, it just means an animal with one horn. Yeah, what's that sound like to you?
A lion.
A rhinoceros, that's right. Okay, now let's check this out. What we got here when we look at this particular prophecy, and you heard it going back and forth. I encourage you to read through the text, okay? That's the whole point of this. But walking through this, what we have is we have this vision where Daniel has the ram, the goat, and then this final horn that grows up and becomes a man, okay? Now, here's a couple things to note. First and foremost, when we look at the ram, what does the ram line up with when we're looking at Daniel's animal descriptions? right? We got the ram with two horns. What's that sound like to you? Say again? Yeah, because the Medo-Persians. Why? Because we've got King Darius and King Cyrus. Now, you guys might recall that when there was the invasion into Jerusalem, excuse me, not Jerusalem, the invasion to Babylon, where they snuck in after the handwriting on the wall, right, and killed King Belshazzar, do you remember who led, like, their guys in there, their army in there, under cover of darkness through the canal system, and killed the king? It was not Darius. It was Cyrus. Cyrus was subject to Darius. Darius was older and more experienced as king. Cyrus was a young guy, okay? So he was the leader of the Persians, but he recognized in this alliance that there's only one king, okay? And in this alliance, King Darius had the experience, the connections, the money, the established name, all of that. And so Cyrus worked under Darius. And Cyrus proved himself in battle over and over and over, notably leading the Persian forces in, the Medo-Persian forces in, to destroy the people within Babylon. And he killed, by the way, he killed the royals, right? He killed all the royals. He kept the advisors, including Daniel, but he didn't kill the people in mass, right? So he took that's a great way to take a city, don't you think? Minimize casualties. Now, later, however, King Darius, who was old, got older. What do old people like to do if they're wealthy and all that stuff? Like to retire.
Oh, yeah.
King Darius didn't die. He just retired off. Okay? And he let Cyrus... I mean, he did die. Don't get me wrong. But he wasn't like killed in a revolution or something. Okay? Darius and Cyrus got along from everything we can see. Right? And then King Cyrus... if you ever want to look into the... reconstruction of Jerusalem. There's two big books. One of them is Ezra. Who knows the second one?
Nehemiah.
Right? Who did Nehemiah work for as cupbearer? King Cyrus. That's right. So it's all connected. Okay? So King Cyrus is the larger of the two horns. He started small, but then he grew and he became mighty. Okay? The Medo-Persian Empire took over, as you saw in the video, took a huge swath of land, but it didn't go very far into Turkey, okay? It didn't go into Egypt, right? It took over the Holy Land, but not really Jerusalem. Such had problems with that, as we identified. They were destroying the temple. There's always revolution there and whatnot. So they're replaced when Alexander the Great comes along. Now the Greeks, which are up to the northeast of Turkey, Alexander the Great, he was the first king of Greece. He united what effectively was a bunch of clans, okay? Brought them together, made an army, and started taking land. And then he would make the deal. You join my army, I don't kill you, right? But here was the kicker. If you joined his army, he would resettle you into the next land, right? Where you don't have family, you don't have friends, you don't feel for the people. And if you went through that battle, well, you could actually be one of the people that settled that land and kept it in order for the Greek army. While he conscripted the new forces to replace you from the people he just conquered. Make sense? So that was how he was able to expand so wide so fast. Now, Alexander the Great came from Greece. Anybody know what historically has been the animal associated with ancient Greece? Here's a tip. It was imprinted upon their coins.
A goat?
A goat. That's right. Greece was all about goats, right? Do you remember Greek people would worship what kind of gods? Greek gods, right? All my questions are easy, I promise. They had this whole pantheon of gods. One of their leading gods that was associated with both order and disorder was a god named Pan, okay? You might have seen this before. The goat-headed dude that dances around plays a little pan flute, mm-hmm. Right? That was Alexander the Great's. That was like one of his chief worshipers. He loved that dude. Okay? Now, they're associated with goats. They got goats all over the place on their coinage. It's part of their culture. Yvonne, as I mentioned, is the name in Hebrew for Greece. Okay? Now, also of note, Daniel chapter 1 through Daniel chapter 2, verse 4 is written in Hebrew. Daniel chapter 2, verse 5. To Daniel 7, at the end of Daniel 7, is written in Aramaic. Okay? Now, in that time, Hebrew and Aramaic, by the way, are very similar. If you can read Hebrew, generally you can figure out Aramaic and vice versa. Okay? But Hebrew and Aramaic were the known language of the people. Okay? When Greece came in, they brought what language? What's that?
Greek.
Greek. That's right. Yeah, Greek people speak Greek. It's okay. Right? They brought Greek. Everywhere they went, they were required to learn and speak Greek. It became the new standard. Okay? Daniel chapter 8, far before this stuff continues, Daniel chapter 8 through Daniel chapter 12, the end, is written in Hebrew. Now, what does that mean to you? If you're reading a book and it's got two languages in it, what does that tell you right off the bat?
That they can write two languages?
They're writing to two different people groups, aren't they? Right? Daniel chapter 1 through 2, verse 4 is written to the Jewish people. It's about the destruction of Jerusalem, right? The enslavement of the people. The interim part that's written in Aramaic is all these visions of Daniel that he's having to prove that God is the God of the pagan people as well, because he is the one and only true God, right? And Nebuchadnezzar recognized that a couple of times, and so does Cyrus and others. And then Daniel chapter 8, it goes back to Hebrew. It goes back to Hebrew because it's written to the Jewish people again, right? And us by extension through Jesus. Now, all that said, what we have is, when we're looking at this, Daniel writes about the ram, and then he writes about this goat with the giant horn. Now, this horn is not really debatable. The very fast goat, right? Alexander's Blitzkrieg offensive. The horn right here that destroyed everything in its path and was super, super strong. Alexander's forces. But there's also the part of the prophecy where the horn's broken off and four additional horns grow up in its place, right? You guys caught that in the video, and it's in the scriptures. Alexander the Great, when he died, he was replaced with his four top generals, okay? Which is quite unusual. What happens when a king dies?
Your son takes over.
That's right. Do you think Alexander had sons?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Legitimate and illegitimate.
Oh, absolutely. He was trying to outdo McDonald's franchise in number. I mean, he was having kids everywhere, all right? In fact, historians think he died at age 36 from syphilis, okay?
Which is an STD, for those of you that didn't know.
Right? Now, we don't actually know that, but it's been some historians think that. So anyway, so Alexander the Great had lots of kids, okay? He also had a brother, right? His brother was actually known to be mentally unfit to be king. Some people think that he had a disease. Some people think that he had a mental retardation. We don't really know, right? But he had a brother, and they had a legitimate firstborn son, okay, who did not gain power. Both of those guys were determined by the four generals to not be fit to lead, and they were given little armies to be in charge of. Right? Just kind of tuck you away. You go be wealthy and live on an island someplace, right? But this kingdom is ours. And then the four generals break up the kingdom. Okay? Now, this all happens at 323. Now, at 330, Josephus records a very interesting thing between Alexander the Great and Jerusalem. Alexander the Great's going through, and he is waxing the countryside. Okay? Until he comes to the city of Tyre. You might have heard of the city before. T-Y-R-E. Okay? The city of Tyre was an elevated city, great defenses. It took Alexander the Great over a year to besiege the city and destroy it. And in that year, he contacted down to Jerusalem, right, who was loosely aligned with him. And the person speaking on behalf, because they didn't have any royalty, right? They'd all been, like, killed off by the Babylonians. So at this stage, at 330, okay, remember back here, the temple's completed in 515, and the people are being led by priests. So who do you think is in charge here? The high priest, his name is Jadis, right here, okay? Jadis gets the letter from Alexander the Great. He says, hey, send forces to Tyre. I want to ally myself with you. I need reinforcements. And he says, no, okay? He says, right now we're aligned with the Medo-Persian Empire. We're aligned to Cyrus. We can't support you, sorry. And he said, once Cyrus is dead, I will support you, right? Alexander the Great's furious. And he's writing. We have letters between Alexander and Cyrus going back and forth as kings write letters to one another. And Alexander is pissed that these people that are right up the street will not come down and help him. Okay, now he does get help from some other Jews that are Samaritans. Okay, Jewish Samaritans in the hillside. Anyways, in 330, that's when Alexander the Great, he's taken out Tyre. He is now looking to kill King Cyrus. But the next city on his list is where, do you think? Jerusalem. That's right.
And it's important to note, too, when we're talking about Josephus. So Josephus' writings are extra-biblical text. He was a scholar and historian of the time. And so this is just more proof and more writings outside of the Bible that validate basically what the Bible is saying.
Very true. Thank you. I apologize. Sometimes I get into talking too fast. Now, Josephus identifies in his records that Alexander the Great comes to Jerusalem, okay, and it's identified in multiple different records because a very weird thing happens. What do you do when an enemy is at your gates?
Defend.
Yeah? Okay, you defend? What else?
Sure.
You might send out somebody to say, I'm sorry, sure. Right? Somebody that can probably be killed and you're not feeling too bad about it. Right? You might take in provisions. Right?
You might negotiate a surrender.
Instead, Jadeus reads and understands Daniel's prophecy. And he says, the Medo-Persian Empire, which is in control, is made up of these two horns. Cyrus is the greater, and he's going to be killed by Alexander. Right? He figures that out. Right? Now, guess how he figures that out? How does God usually communicate with people of the times? In dreams. He has a dream where he sees the goat destroy the ram's horn. And he says, I understand now. God's letting me know that Alexander's going to win. Hasn't happened yet. So when they show up, the high priest has everybody dressed in white linens, okay? Symbol of purity, right? Also known as symbol of surrender. And he and the priest dress in their priestly garments. He's in full priestly garb, okay? So he's got the chest plate, he's got the headdress, he's got the whole thing, right? And he goes out and he stands at the front of this line of people that's going out from Jerusalem's gates, okay, down the mountain. You know, who knows, maybe a mile long of people. And he's standing there at the front of the line with his priest right behind him, and he's holding the scroll of Daniel. And Alexander comes up, and he's leading his forces, riding up to the gates, and he sees all these people out here with no weapons. And he turns and he gets off his horse, and he goes up, and the first guy he sees in the front is Jadeus. They've never met, right? Before Jadeus can say a thing, Alexander walks up and he says, I know you. And he expresses how God gave him a dream in which he was going to meet and make peace with this man. And he recognized him because of his priestly turban, and he has a gold plate up here with God's name engraved upon it. And that's how he knew that that was the man that he was not to do harm to, but he was to make peace with. Jerusalem was the only city, that he ever approached and did not destroy. Okay? Every other city, he broke down the walls and he took by force. Every single one. Even ones that surrendered to him, he would go in and destroy the temples to show his superiority. Instead, he was led into Jerusalem. The people gave themselves freely over and said, we belong to you. We're one of your good guys now. And he was led by the high priest to the temple, and is the only pagan that we know of, and it's debatable whether or not this was right. The high priest led him into the temple and walked him through the offering of a sacrifice to the one true Yahweh God. And Alexander the Great is the only pagan in history, whoever that we know of, that ever offered a sacrifice at the Temple Mount to the one true Yahweh God. Right? And he took it as a sign of blessing. He left there, according to Josephus, he left there with the scroll of Daniel in his arms. See how rare that would be? At 330 BC, right? That the Jewish people would willingly give over a holy scroll, but they gave it to him because he read in the scroll, he was shown by the priest, and he was identified as being the goat with the horn. And he also knew that he was going to win over Cyrus, right? And we have letters that identify that. And he also knew that he was going to die and be replaced by four other people. Okay? Now, we don't know how many generals he had. We only know at the end. Right? So maybe the Bible influenced that, the scriptures. Maybe it didn't. I don't know. I don't think he knew he was going to die at 36, though.
No.
Okay? Now, Alexander the Great, he continues his conquest. He, of course, kills Cyrus, right? He takes and takes over the Medo-Persian Empire, as you saw, everywhere really fast. He's replaced by four generals. These are the names. I'm just going to say L, C, P, and S, okay? Because I don't want to pronounce them. They're tough to pronounce. But Ptolemy, the P, he took over Egypt and the area around Jerusalem, in that area, the Gaza area. And that was the borderland to Seleucus, who took over the Babylonian area. So one's on Egypt, on the east side, one's on the west side of the Holy Land. And the two of them had border skirmishes, right? But those are the two. The reason they're starred is they're the only ones that had influence over the Holy Land for the duration from the Greco-Roman Empire. Okay? Now, all that's history. That all came to pass. Right? What's that mean about the rest of the prophecy, too, you think? Well, first let me ask you this. I've explained this, and I'm going to combat speed, okay? But I've explained this. There's tons and tons and tons and tons of details in this. But does this stack up as just coincidence to you? Well, welcome to the main opinion of all the historians that are on board. We've had people studying this for a real long time, and they just cannot make it line up with other historical events. Okay? It lines up really awesome with this one, you know, with the progression of kings. But you have all these prophecies of Daniel going hundreds of years in the future that are just coming to pass with very specific details, okay? And it's just, it's really hard to explain that away. I don't think you can be an intellectually honest person and be able to stand back and say, no, there's nothing there. There's no there. Okay?
So if all these visions of Daniel's did come true, and we have historical evidence in and outside of the Bible that all these things came true, and then there are visions and prophecies of Daniel that haven't lined up with historical events yet, what does that tell you about those prophecies and visions?
Let me ask you this. I'll put it another way. Say you got a buddy. Everybody in here has got a buddy from one time in their life, right? By show of hands? Outstanding. Micah, you got a buddy somewhere in there? Outstanding. Say you had a buddy, and that buddy started predicting the future of lottery numbers. Okay? And didn't buy tickets or anything, but just every night he'd go and he'd be like, they're getting ready to do the Powerball draw, and he would just tell you the numbers. And you'd ask him why, and he'd be like, oh, I get it in a dream the night before. Right? Say your buddy does that 17 days in a row. Right? Or 17 drawings in a row. And he's always right. Right? And on the 18th, he says, hey, do you want to know the numbers? What are you going to do?
Buy a ticket.
Why?
I don't know.
Because he's been reliable the last few times.
Because he's been reliable.
Buy a ticket like Captain Ocean.
Yeah. He's reliable. Right? But say you got a buddy that walks up and says, I had a dream. I know the Powerball numbers. Are you going to run out and buy a ticket with the same enthusiasm?
Probably.
So?
No.
I don't know. I think I would look at him like you're crazy and be like, you've never told the future before. Why should I believe you? Prophets are proven when they're right. That's how you know they're trustworthy. False prophets will tell you things that they figure out ways that it can be right. Nostradamus, for example. Right? People, there's books written about Nostradamus being this famous prophet. Right? And you go look at it and you're like, well, if you critically think about it, you're like, well, yeah, okay, he says that this happened because this happened, but that doesn't mean that the nuclear bomb here is going to be the flaming arrow of that prophecy. Right? There's too many question marks. Daniel removes the question marks. Right? It's just, it's too accurate. It's freaky. Okay? So we got to pay attention to it. I think we should pay attention to it. Okay? Now, it doesn't want anything from you, but it does want to give you information. That's why you should pay attention to it. The four horns it identifies then turn into this little horn that grows up towards heaven. Okay? You guys remember that from the video, right? Now, here's something that's important with that. When these two guys died, or excuse me, when all the four generals died, and when their empires continued on, people looked to try and figure out who the little horn is, right? And there's some qualifiers in Daniel, right? I'm gonna pull it up real quick. When it comes to Daniel, it says, this is Daniel chapter 8, beginning of verse 9. Out of one of them came, this is the four horns, out of one of those four horns came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and towards the beautiful land. What's the beautiful land, by the way? Take a guess. What would God call the beautiful land?
Israel.
Yeah, Israel. All right. What would Daniel call the beautiful land? Israel. Right. So this horn grows to the south and to the east and towards the beautiful land. So where's it coming from compared to Israel? If it's coming south and east, where's its origination?
To the west of Israel.
Yeah, north and west. That's right. So now we have a geographical location for where this horn's going to be coming from. It grew until it reached, now here's the important part, reached the host of heavens and it threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. First off, who's the host of heaven? Not Jesus. Close. God. Right? We refer to in Scripture, we talk about the heavenly host. That's the angels. Right? We talk about the host, right? But the whole of heaven. Right? Who's responsible for all of heaven? God. Right? That's the Father's job. In that personage. Right? And then we have, in the same sentence, he's talking about the prince of the host. Who's the prince of the host? That's Jesus. That's exactly right. This creature wants to climb up into the heavens, and it casts down a third of the stars, and it tries to set itself up to be as high as Jesus. Who does that sound like to you? Same thing. We're describing the Antichrist, and it is literally describing Satan. Okay? Check this out. If we go to Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, and Revelation 12, it describes what the enemy is like in its character. Okay? Now, you might have heard the original sin was Eve taking the fruit from the tree. What's the original sin, Lily?
When Satan decided to rebel against God in heaven.
How do we know when he rebelled? Where was Satan when the fruit came off the tree? He was in the garden. He indwelled the snake, remember? Right? Which had legs at that point. God took him away. Right? If Satan was in the garden, and the garden was placed upon earth, and so Satan was then upon earth, we know that Satan had been cast out of heaven by that point. So the original sin of pride, which would have predated the sin of mankind, okay? Satan's pride, that he wants to be as great as God, that's identified in Isaiah 14, it's referenced in Ezekiel 28, and it is given specific details in Revelation 12, okay, that describe the beast that swept a third of the stars from the heavenly host. That's in Revelation 12. Satan, when he got cast out of heaven, all the angels that were following him went with him. We call them demons now, right? But they're angels. Yes, and if you ever want to check out, read Isaiah chapter 14, and it describes the beauty of the cherub, the chief of cherubs. He was set up to be the head of God's personal guard. Okay? Satan held arguably the most trusted position in heaven. Right? You can read Isaiah 14 and you can get more info on that, okay? Now, I say all that because I want to say this. When we look at this, a lot of people will be like, in history, they're trying to shove this prophecy into historical events, right? I'm not a fan of that. I am a fan of looking at history and thinking about it critically. Is there any other empire that had two kings, for example, one replaced the other, where they were still on the same animal, right? The horns are still working together. King Darius, like I said, he went to retirement. He's still around. He's still offering guidance and advice. He's still helping in the backside. He's still funding, right? He's still a horn on the ram. He's just not the chief horn anymore, right? Any other empire where that's happened? You know, history doesn't find one. Then we look at the goat references, and this, you know, coming in and destroying this empire with the two kings that are working together, one bigger than the other. When do we find that in history? And there's just no other reference. Does that make sense? So when we look at history and we examine it critically, we're not trying to shove the prophecy. I don't ever want you to do that. Don't shove the prophecy into the historical facts, okay? That's what cheaters do. Look at the historical facts and then compare the prophecy, right? If it's true of God, it will fit, all right? Period. Critically thinking, it'll fit. And there's just so many, like the whole goat thing being on the coins and being the symbol of, come on, man, right? Greece didn't exist when Daniel had this vision. He was hundreds of years before that, okay? So, man. Anyway, so we're back up to here. 330, we get Alexander the Great in Jerusalem. The Jews join. 323, okay? 7 years later, that's when we see the division of Greece take place because of the death of Alexander the Great, okay? Those four guys die. Two have influence over Israel. And then we get up here to Antius in 168. It's a couple hundred years later, okay? 168 B.C. You guys might have heard about the Maccabean Revolution, right? In fact, if you ever look at a Bible that was printed before 1874, it contains the first and second Maccabee books. They're still part of the Apocrypha. They're still recognized by the Catholic Church's doctrine. They're history books. Okay?
So in the Bible, where they would be at the very end of the New Testament, before the very end of the Old Testament, before the New Testament starts.
We call that the intertestamental period. It was about 450 years, okay, that we had this gap in our Protestant Bible. But a lot of stuff was happening, okay? We had a whole revolution in that period, a Jewish revolution, a revolt, rather, not a revolution. It was called the Maccabean Revolt, and it happened in and around 168 BC. In that, we see a lot of pressure from the Greco-Roman leadership to conquer the Jews. This is where crucifixion was happening all the time. They'd go to a village, and they would, like, literally bring a pig with them, slaughter the pig, and then line up the villagers, and they'd all have to come up and get a mouthful, okay? And that was the way that they were trying to destroy or break the Jewish religion, because, of course, you can't eat pig if you're a Jew. It's not kosher. So they were forcing people to violate their religion, right, under penalty of death. Those who didn't do it were crucified.
Did they cook the pig?
I don't know. It just depends on them, I guess. Right? They didn't exactly like the Jews. And then, so in one of those situations, they showed up, they slaughtered a pig, and they were lining up the villagers, and this happened to be a village where you had a gentleman, his last name was Maccabee, okay? He was a father with four sons, right, that we know of, and he was the head holy man, if you will, the rabbi of the village. And they brought him out first, and they said, eat, and he's like, absolutely not. And they said, we're going to crucify you. He said, I will die before the Lord. I'm not going to eat pig. And so they were preparing him for crucifixion when his sons, two of his sons, slaughtered the leadership, right? Came out with swords swinging, killed the leaders, right? And then it became became a sword fight in the village, and they ended up slaughtering all the Roman soldiers, okay? And then they said, well, they're gonna when they find out about this, they're gonna burn our village to the ground. So they sent runners to the next villages and said, let's start a revolt. And that's how they started the Maccabean Revolt, okay? Now, there's a lot of history to that. I can't go into it today. It's very interesting stuff. But that's going on when this guy, Antiochus, hits the temple. And he sets Zeus up on the altar. He slaughters a pig in the temple, right? Sprays blood everywhere, desecrates the temple, right? Now, if you look again to Daniel, it says here, beginning in verse 11, it set itself up, this is talking about the Antichrist, right? It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. It was the place was desecrated. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifices were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did. The truth was thrown to the ground. That is describing what is referred to as the abomination that causes desolation. Okay? So a lot of historians believed, and some still do, that Antiochus fulfilled Daniel's prophecy. Except the temple was restored. Mm-hmm. So, and Antiochus, he didn't go to heaven. He didn't cast down a third of the stars. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So, I don't think he fits. Which guy?
What? So, like, when, like, Satan came down, he cast down, like, a third of the stars in the
earth.
And then when the Antichrist, he gets down another third?
Ah,
or
so.
Or is it the same third?
Yeah, same guy. The Antichrist goes up and he casts down about a third of the stars. They refer to the stars as hosts. There's your angel reference.
Right, but what he's asking is, so that happened with Satan before and brought a third with him.
Yes.
And it's just a separate incident.
I see. Yeah.
Where the Antichrist is bringing a third.
So now we go into linear time versus non-linear time. Okay? Does God exist in time?
Nope.
Does God exist outside of time? God created time. So what, when we look at it, God knows everything, yes? Because he sees the whole of the timeline. Yeah. Now, I don't want to cook your noodle, okay? It's a whole other conversation to go into that, right? But I do want to say that when we talk about identifiers, in this dream that is explained by Gabriel, right, in Daniel chapter 8, the latter half of chapter 8 is Gabriel telling Daniel what the vision is about, okay? And in this vision, the angel Gabriel identifies this dude, this little horn, is one that will ascend to heaven and take a third of the host. He's giving an identifier of this person. Does that make sense? Now, has the identifier already happened? Yeah, it could have. Because we see Daniel, he's up receiving this from the angel Gabriel. He's in spirit in heaven. Does that make sense? Now, that I know this is a toughie to think in nonlinear and linear at the same time. Okay? I think it's a toughie. My brain doesn't function very well. But just think of it this way. Things that happen in heaven don't have to happen on our timeline. Does that make sense? The two are non-compatible. They're two different dimensions, if you will.
So they're giving the identifier about bringing down a third to basically be able to tell us who that is, that it is actually Satan.
They want to get the fingerprint of the guy. They don't want us to make a mistake. Okay? God has got order and clarity. So now we get to this Antichrist guy, he doesn't fit part of the prophecy. But you see how some historians are like, but he fits some other parts of the prophecy, so therefore we think it's this guy. I don't want you to do that with prophetic reading. I want you to look at it critically, okay? If God designs for it to fit, it'll fit. So you can question those aspects, right? And you should. By the way, that was a very good question. I'm glad that you were able to see the incompatibility except for the lack of linear time. I'm going to continue. Okay. Jesus is born about 4 BC-ish, right? I know zero set the clock, but we kind of got it wrong. And then in 70 AD, the temple is destroyed by a Roman leader named Titus. Okay? Destroys the temple. It's not been rebuilt since. Does that make sense? Did he desecrate the temple? Well, no. It just says he went in and burned it down. Right? He set it ablaze, and then they knocked the walls down. Right? After he took all the gold and silver out of there, by the way. He robbed it. So he destroyed it. He robbed it and destroyed it, and it's not been rebuilt. What's on the Temple Mount today? Yeah, the Muslims built a golden dome there to make sure that the Jews couldn't build an altar to God. Okay? But they have the Western Wall.
So right now, over built on top of the rubble of the temple is a pagan religion's temple.
Right.
Trying
to show they have superiority over God.
There is the Western Wall that the Jews are still able to go to. That was part of the original temple. But as of right now, the temple has not been rebuilt.
Now, I want to hit this last point. When we're looking at all this, and we're like, okay, well, what's going on here? We have the Antichrist identified, and this guy's not a man, okay? This is not, it might be in human form, but this is not going to be a human being. Does that make sense? I am firmly convinced that, and you got Satan, and you have his high priest, they're going to be there, okay? I'm firmly convinced that they are going to be indwelt, Satan is going to be indwelling the Antichrist. And there's some really good stuff I can give to you after about that. Anyways, he's identified. Satan's desire is identified here. We know that he wants to rule over heaven, okay? He wants to take the place of Jesus. He wants to sit upon the throne. That is exactly what the little horn is identified as, growing up and going up to the host of heaven and such. But then, at the end, we have this. The coming of Christ that will destroy the Antichrist, and he'll be killed not by human hands, okay? And what is Jesus, what happens when he takes over? He's coming in Armageddon. How does he destroy his enemies? That's exactly right. You're both exactly right. Okay, he destroys the enemies the same way God created the universe. He speaks.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, all of that said, the slaughter of Armageddon, it's not a battle. It's referred to as a battle. It's not. This is going to be a one-sided thing. By the way, if you're on Jesus' team, you're going to show up with weapons, okay, to the Battle of Armageddon. What's that mean for you? You're probably going to be in the fight, right? But how? You know what it's like going into a video game in God mode? It's going to be like that, okay? I'm hoping for a sword. I like swords. All right. Now, we've got all of this. This is all Daniel's prophecy. What's not been fulfilled so far is this. The Antichrist has not come. How do we know this? How do we know it wasn't Antichrist? In Matthew 24, which happens well after, okay, Jesus describes in Matthew 24 the abomination that causes desolation. And he refers to it in the future tense. It has not come, right? He has not come yet. That means it can't be Antichrist, right? Not if you believe Jesus, unless there's more than one abomination, right? Could it be different characters that are being used by Satan, directly or indirectly, to cause abomination and desolation? Sure, but is it this guy?
No.
What do you think? Look for the fingerprint. Look for the one that has power to bring demons into the fight.
Because it does talk about multiple antichrists with a little a. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about the antichrist with big A.
So I think we might have time for Matthew 24, do we?
Quickly.
Okay. Let me pull it up. I had it up here. Darn it. I went to something else. I went to Revelation 12. Let me pull up Matthew 24 for you. It's worth it. I promise.
It is worth it.
Okay. Now, this is what Jesus said. He's being asked by his disciples about the end days, about this. Okay? His disciples knew what Daniel was talking about. And this is what he says. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you." That's verse 4. Verse 5. "For many will come in my name, claiming I am Messiah, and will deceive many." False Jesuses. "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come." Okay? So wars and rumors of wars don't mean that the end is come. "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of birth pains." Right? Not the baby. "Then you will be handed over to be..." Here's where it gets in. The disciples that follow Christ. "Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me." Right? Christians are going to be enemy number one. "At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other." Christians are going to abandon their faith and turn others in. "And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people." Okay? "Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold." Christians are going to withdraw and stop gospeling. "But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom," you've heard this before, "will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." You've heard that we're about 8 years away from reaching all tribes, all tongues with the gospel of Christ. Okay? There's an organization that's pushing that because they want to bring the end. They want to get to heaven.
You should wait a little bit.
Verse 15. "So when you see standing in the holy place..." Where's the holy place?
Jerusalem.
Yeah, specifically?
The temple.
The temple, right? And the holy place is the place where the sacrifices are made. Behind the curtain is the Holy of Holies, right? That's where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. The sacrifices were on the altar in the holy. Make sense? "When you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand," this is Jesus' words, "then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down and take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak." Run. Okay, that's what he's saying. He's saying run. "How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again." Okay? And he goes on to describe some of the horrors. Okay? Have we faced that? No. Jesus has not come. The end has not come. Okay? The Antichrist has not come. What has taken place? The ram has been destroyed. The goat's horn's been broken. The four smaller horns, which are these kingdoms that established the Roman Empire, okay, specifically these two, Ptolemy and Seleucus, they established the Greco-Roman Empire, which gave us what kind of government?
Democracy.
It gave us a democratic government, right? If you ever wonder why guys are interested in Roman girls, why guys are interested in the Roman Empire, it's because it was the start of the government that we now serve in, okay? We still have, across the world, in most places, some form of republic, okay? Representative government. Maybe not a republic, but representative government. This is still going on. That means we're sitting inside of this era. Right? You guys, that's what we're looking for. That's what I want to get you focused on. Now, is this trustworthy? Do you think? Yeah, if you're a thinking person. Micah, what do you think?
Is that part of Daniel's vision trustworthy?
Is there enough there to get your brain juices flowing? Yeah? Do you think it's prophetic? Do you think it's telling the future? Yeah, accurately. Okay. Do you think it's talking about the rapture timeline? Right? Do you know what the rapture is? There's another spot in Scripture. We should actually do a class just on that.
Yeah.
Okay, on the rapture. But the body of Christ will be taken up into heaven before the seven-year tribulation begins. The seven-year tribulation is going to be the worst period in the history of the planet. Okay? That's the tribulation period. It'll be a 7-year period, 7-year block, which means rapture happens, we get out of here. If you aren't ready, you get stuck in the tribulation. And you either survive or die over the next 7 years or turn your back on Christ.
And you still have the possibility within that 7-year period to be saved. Mm-hmm. But the idea would be, I mean, nobody wants to go through that. Like he said, it's going to be the worst ever on the planet. And those that do become Christians during that time will continue to be enemy number one and will continue to be slaughtered and tortured and slaughtered.
So it comes down to the question, are you prepared? Here's the question for us, and I've been a Christian a while now. I think I've been a Christian longer than anybody in this room, right? I can tell you that there have probably been times in my life where I have walked away from Christ, and if the rapture had come, I likely would not have been swept up, right? Can you lose your salvation? No. Can you walk away from it? Yes. We have free will. God gave us that. We can abandon him if we choose, okay? He's going to let us go because he loves us, and he wants us to come back. So what it comes down to is repentance, turning away from our sin so that we can follow after the righteousness of God, forgiveness that he gives us, which, by the way, we are required to extend to others. That's a hard thing in our society today. We're not very sociable, and forgiveness of others is one of the things that's taken a hit. And then lastly, do we have faith? Right? Is that holding us together? Now, I'm going to stop here, okay? But I do want to just offer to you this, that if you are at the point where you need to embrace one of these, repentance, forgiveness, or a strengthening of your faith, right? Like I have had to do on multiple occasions throughout my life. Come talk to me and Elisa after we break, and we'll be happy to give you all sorts of tools, encouragement, whatever else might be.